Public Safety Finance Committee will come to order. Our agenda for today is to hear the, I guess not the governor's recommendations, but the response to the governor's recommendations and have discussion about cuts that the committee will have to consider.
No.
I know. You should have a spreadsheet in your packet that with the governor's recommendations, and we're going to take the Department of Corrections first, followed by the Department of Public Safety, and then Community Corrections will give corrections and public safety roughly 30 minutes each to, hopefully you can tell us what the impact of these cuts that the governor is proposing might be on your agencies. This committee will have to decide whether the governor has made, whether these cuts are the cuts that we want to make, or if there's any other revenue to be found. I'm not sure at this point. So, why don't we first hear from corrections? Is the commissioner here? Commissioner Sabian, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, we appreciate this opportunity to present the governor's budget. In the next few days, you're going to hear a lot of testimony about the impact of his proposed cuts to various entities. And I guess in making this difficult decision, we just ask you to carefully consider DOC's unique position and our obligation to public safety. Obviously, we have the biggest budget in this committee, and we're very concerned what further cuts would do to us. We feel very strongly that reductions to our budget would severely compromise public safety and as well as the safety of our staff. The governor's recommended budget did minimize the cuts to corrections for several reasons. First, that most of our services are mandated and are public safety related, including the prison operations and community supervision. And these funds for the three delivery systems for community supervision have not been reduced at all, and we feel very strongly that they shouldn't be. The governor also considered the fact that our department has received substantial cuts in the past. If in the past we ever had any fat in the budget, I can guarantee you we don't have it anymore. We have eliminated over 300 positions, 10% of a management and supervisory positions in our facility and support operations, and consolidated and centralized in many, many places. I feel very strongly that any further reductions would compromise our services. We also are facing a huge deficit already in our department for 2009, approximately $10 million. I think we have a handout that we've passed out already, and the governor certainly took that into consideration when looking at where to make his cuts. I think, you know, we all, this committee and our department, we all share an obligation to protect the staff who perform the incredibly difficult and dangerous jobs that we have to do in our department. Every day, violent offenders, gang members, child killers, and others enter our prison. You know, while it's an ending for them being out on the street for a while, it's the beginning of our agents and our correctional staff dealing with them every single day, 7 days a week. While I think we don't talk a whole lot about it, but we handle things in the prisons very well, but staff are at constant risk. And I think just the few things that you've heard about lately, I think you understand that. We have had violent rape of one of our female staff in 2 years ago. We have, every day, we have some sort of incident that the staff have to deal with. We are very lean in those prisons, and we feel very strongly that if we have cuts in the prisons, that it puts our staff in even more jeopardy. The recent incident with the tunnel, we did find homemade shanks in the tunnel. We know that if we had found that tunnel when the offenders were in there, that something would have happened as far as either hurting or killing one of our staff. So I'm not being overdramatic here. I'm telling you these are the facts, and this is what we're dealing with every single day. As we testified last session, laying off hundreds of correctional staff, if we took a 3% cut, it would be necessary to lay off hundreds of staff. And as I've mentioned, in the community as well as in the prisons, that would be dangerous. I guess the new funding last session primarily addressed a strong commitment that we all had here to reentry services. The governor also has a commitment to that, so reentry was not cut in this budget, nor were the sex offender management or the supervision in the community. We just want to give you a real short, and I promise it will be short, a couple of graphs here to just show you where the money is. On the first page, if you look at it, and Barbara Cox called it a very, very humble pie chart, on the first page, it is, if you look, that 80% of our budget goes to, 71% of our budget goes to institutions. 80% of that institution budget goes for staff. Support operations is a very small part of the budget. There is where in the past, when we've had to cut over $54 million in the last few years, that's where a lot of the cuts came, as well as in the institutions and community service. Community service, I don't think we've ever laid it out quite like this before, but if you look at community services, the total budget is $121 million. Of that, $81.2 million is pass-through money. So that provides not only for the three delivery systems in the community, but things like halfway houses and treatment in the community. The second page, Assistant Commissioner David Crist is just going to go over it, but what we want to show you is what the mandates are and which one of those you want us to stop doing if we get cut.
Assistant Commissioner Crist?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Crist. I'm an Assistant Commissioner with the Department of Corrections. We incarcerate over 9,400 adults and juveniles in the department and provide rehabilitative programming for them. I know from my experience starting out in this business, I was a corrections officer at Shakopee, Stillwater, and Oak Park Heights. And the last 10 years, I've been a warden at Stillwater and Lionel Lake. So I remember vividly my experiences as a CO and the importance of safety in the work environment where we're housing our most dangerous and violent offenders. Also, we provide services through our Office of Special Investigations, where they monitor gang activities in our facilities on a daily basis. They did 375 fugitive apprehensions in the community last year. Those were release violators who have absconded, or level 3 sex offenders who've gone missing from where they're supposed to be. And they conducted 946 internal investigations and investigations in concert with local law enforcement last year. We provide for the health care that's required by constitutional case law, and we provide rehabilitative programming in chemical dependency, sex offender, and education services in the facilities division.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any other testimony, Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Harley Nelson. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Community Services. On the next chart, the next page over, you'll see the community services part of it, the public safety issues that you have there is adult felony supervision, and the DOC does it in 55 counties, and in 27 of those 55 counties, the DOC under contract to those counties provides services for juvenile supervision and adult misdemeanor supervision. And the other 32 counties are under the Community Corrections Act, and the way that population breaks down, approximately a little over 100,000, 103,000 are in the Community Corrections Act counties. Those 32 counties are usually metropolitan, larger counties, larger areas. And then the about 18,000 DOC people under probation supervision and 19,000 in the CPO counties. The CPO counties get reimbursed for up to 50% of their costs for those juveniles and the adult misdemeanors, and even those counties where they contract and pay the state for that services, they get reimbursed for up to 50%. There's an additional 4,000 supervised police offenders in the community who are those who have come out of prison, and they are supervised by the Community Corrections Act counties and the Department of Corrections. The statewide intensive supervised release program is a special program. The statute specifies it has to be ratios of 1 to 15, which is a very low ratio, but these are some of the most dangerous offenders coming out of prison, be they sex offenders or very assaultive individuals. The department does those offenders in all of the counties, with the exception of Arrowhead, Hennepin, Anoka, Dakota, Ramsey, and Dodgeville, or Olmsted, where they, under contract, provide that intensive supervised release. Two other programs that aren't necessarily the most dangerous offenders, but they are coming out of prison and need to have close supervision as part of their program, is the Conditional Release Program offenders, which is a new program that started several years ago, and these people have gone through some type of treatment in the institution and are now coming out, and hopefully will make it on supervised release with that intensive type of supervision. And the Challenge Incarceration Program, which has been a very successful program. They go through a boot camp thing, which is a boot camp. I call it boot camp plus because there's a lot of treatment in the institution. And then they come out on the intensive supervised release. And the Department of Corrections provides that service throughout the whole state. Sex offender risk assessment, community notification. This is where cases are screened either to look for referrals or to give them a classification of risk level 1, 2, or 3 as part of the notification process for sex offenders that have been convicted and have served time in our prison. Community Corrections Act and Grants Administration, here's where the Community Corrections Act subsidy would flow out of the CPO reimbursements, the treatment programs, halfway houses, and so forth is the area that this would come out of. Interstate Compact, there's over 3,000 requests are processed and monitored each year, and these are offenders coming from another state to live in Minnesota. They could be Minnesotans that went to another state, got in trouble, and are coming back to their homes and need supervision services, or they could be people that have are Minnesota are transferring to other states, and this is under the Interstate Compact. Facility licensing inspections, that's a very busy unit with 103 adults and 108 juvenile facilities. It includes 30 out-of-state juvenile facilities in other states that we monitor. And hearing to release, there's release plans for over 6,000 offenders that are approved. And those offenders during the year, there's a lot of things that are happening with those that are out, and they some of them are out for long periods of time. They may be violations, technical violations, where they are looked at and restructured and attempted kept in the community. If the violation is so serious or if there's multiple violations, they may be brought back to prison. And over here on the right, you see the non-mandated services, and that's not to demean those services. Reentry programming is new and started and hopes to be successful to keep those people out by providing some more intensive type of reentry services for them. But that is something that, while there's legislative appropriations for it, it is not something that is absolutely required. But it is not on the cut list, and we're hoping to get those programs up and look at our success rate and do some studies with that one. And Sentence to Service is a much older program. It's been very successful in the community. Very good public relations. They clean up after floods. They do some other things. They sometimes reduce the jail population because they certain judiciary judges will give them time off their jail sentence for providing that service in the community. But those are non-mandated services in the sense that if they're not appropriated money for it, the service isn't there. Unlike probation supervision, if we were to cut five probation officers averaging caseloads of 100 each, there'd be 500 offenders that would not go away. They would have to be put on other caseloads, and bringing those caseloads up to sizes is quite heavy.
Almost through here. Page four with the operating budget challenges. Again, I emphasize that our operations have a direct impact on public safety, and we're entering 2009 with a known shortages of over $10 million. We have a handout that shows you the detail and why those are, but I mean, if you look at their major issues, and we're doing everything we can to figure out how to absorb those. One of the things we have had for a while is a freeze on non-essential positions. We've put a freeze on out-of-state travel, spending on just essential things. So we're trying to do everything we can to absorb that. And again, to have cuts on top of that would really cut into major core services. The challenge is the fact that over the last decade we've had a 76% increase in prison population and a 37% increase in the number of people under supervision. And while that has lessened in terms of prison population, it has slowed, it still is growing. We have no ability to limit our intake or control over the volumes of who comes to prison, can't put them on a waiting list. We have no significant alternative funding sources. And, we're really struggling with, we know that 95% are getting out of prison, and we need to provide some opportunities for change. So that's all part of this budget. The last page is the specific recommendations for cuts, and the recommendation is $2.5 million to reduce appropriation to reimburse counties for housing short-term offenders, and $600,000 to reduce funding for sentencing to service. And those reductions are equal to the increases that you appropriated last year during the 2007 session.
Thank you, Commissioner, for your testimony. I have a quick question, and then I'm going to open it up to members. Can you tell the committee either today or provide the number of deputy and assistant commissioners that you have at the Department of Corrections?
Mr. Chair, I could tell you right now.
All
I've got two deputies and one assistant commissioner.
You have two deputies?
Right.
I'm talking about your whole, throughout the whole Department of Corrections. That's
okay. Two assistants. I don't know who I forgot, but I feel really bad.
You said that there's two deputies and two assistant commissioners? Is that right?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And you said that the 300 positions that you said, or the hundreds of staff that you'd have to lay off with the 3% cut, are those, would they be actual layoffs, or would they be positions that are currently unfilled? And when you say hundreds, what do you mean by hundreds?
Mr. Chair, it would depend on where we cut. When we had, everyone had to submit budget cuts, and it was pretty much throughout the department. Every one of them was a position. There aren't open positions because we're not chilling to save money in ones that are like operations and clerical and that sort of thing. We are filling all of the positions that would be officers or agents. So depending on where the cuts, and like if we eliminated treatment, we would be talking about a couple hundred positions just for that, but then we would have to hire additional security officers because the treatment staff also supervise.
Representative Smith.
Chairman, thank you. Commissioner, two or three questions. You referenced dramatic growth in offender population, specifically 76% increase in prison population, 37% increase in those on probation. Where does Minnesota rank? Despite that, where does Minnesota rank relative to the other states in percent of incarceration versus population?
Mr. Fabian.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we are the 48th lowest in terms of how many people we lock up.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, apply the same question on the community supervised release people on probation. Where do we rank?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we're about the fifth highest in terms of the number of people that are under supervision in all three delivery systems in Minnesota.
Representative Smith.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Final question. So we are one of the lowest states that incarcerates, one of the highest states that releases offenders into the general population. These two growth percentages that you referred, 76% in the prison population, 37% in community supervision, has that trend been reversed? In other words, are we incarcerating more often than we are releasing? Unlike what we've done in the past, where we incarcerate little and release a lot. Poorly worded question. Are we throwing more people in jail than we used to? And is this part of the problem? And if so, what? That's the question.
Just say Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, in the last decade, one of the dynamics driving the dramatic increase in prison population was meth offenders. That has leveled off in the last few years of that of the decade, due largely to laws that were passed that criminalized the supply chain and manufacture. So that's helped our population level off. We're still increasing, but it's at a much more modest rate than it was earlier in the decade.
Mm-hmm.
Just if I could add to that, there's also an increase in the length of stay, and that has something to do with the increased sentences on certain offenders, certainly sex offenders and so forth. So there has been a slight shift in that, but not as dramatic as one would think.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any other questions. I think what I'm seeing is while you have money problems and you can't select your clientele, that's done for you. We still are one of the lowest, if not the lowest, states in the incarcerated ranking with the other states. That was my question. That was my point. Thank you.
Commissioner Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I listened attentively. And is this information that you presented in here, is this your 4% or is your 4% above this?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this isn't the 4%. This is what the governor decided to cut.
And were you involved with the decision making with the governor on this? Was your advice requested and adhered to?
Mr. Fabian.
Yes, it was.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, something that's been near and dear to me all these years has been the probation, and I know that something that's been near and dear to you in the last 2 years has been the reentry stuff, and to have so much of that wiped out bothers me. Commissioner Nelson, could you tell us really the effect on POs?
Deputy Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, they're not being wiped out. The two areas that cut in our budgets are reduced appropriation to reimburse counties for housing short-term offenders, and then reduced in funding for sentence of service. And we were able to stay away from cuts and reductions in the probation officers, and we're able to stay away from cuts and reentry. With
totally.
In the governor's recommendation, yes, totally.
Then, Mr. Chair,
Representative Murphy,
consider the impact of the cut for fishing and community corrections to property taxes. Did you talk about that at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, I didn't have that conversation with the governor's people, but I'm sure that they did talk about it.
And I know that there's some other people that are going to talk later on, and perhaps they'll talk about the impact on property taxes. But,
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, if I could just add a little something to that. The major reduction of the $2.5 million in reimbursing counties for housing short-term offenders was dollars that were added in the last legislative session for the biennium. And this, they will get that money for fiscal year 08. It is coming out of the budget and coming out of the base for fiscal year 09. They will have some time to deal with that to some extent, but as the counties looked at those dollars, those are revenue dollars for them when they're housing and holding the short-term offenders. That number of the short-term offenders has gone up rather dramatically after that legislation was changed. Maybe I should hand out this document here to help understand why some of those per diems came down. And originally there's $1.2 million in the base, and it was hoped to get those per diems up to about $30 a day. With this reduction, they'll be back down to about $9 a day. But I don't know if the counties will necessarily have to increase their, they'll have to answer this question, but I don't know if they'll have to increase their taxes dramatically as they lose these revenues, depending upon how they anticipated this in their budget.
Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's, to this point, I remember when we shifted the short-term offenders to the counties, and I believed that it was the state's responsibility. So could the state house these prisoners for $9 a day, which is what we're asking the counties to do? And if not, how much would it cost the state to house the offenders, which I believe are our responsibility?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hilstrom, the cost for per day in the prison is higher than that. Usually the jails are looking at about $55 a day. Some of those costs, though, however, the ones that have major problems with those are the jails that are filled up and have to contract out and find beds. Those that are housing them in their own jail, if they have additional beds, it costs them the variable cost. There's a fixed cost there, but that doesn't necessarily increase, and that would vary from jail to jail. But yes, they are not able to house a prisoner for $9 or $10 a day. But it's not costing them necessarily the $55. It's probably costing them something less, maybe around $15 a day for the variable cost if they have to bring in additional staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we now have open beds, and we are not bringing back everyone from the facilities that we lease out. And so now we have open beds, and so our variable cost as a state would be less as well. So my question to you is, what would it cost us to house these short-term offenders, because they are, in fact, the state's responsibilities?
Deputy Commissioner Nelson.
Mr. Chair, I'll turn that over to the Assistant Commissioner of Institutions, and he'd probably be better able to answer that.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to let Dan Storkamp answer that question, because he will have this, better facts than I will.
Okay. Storkamp, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, Director of Information and Technology for the Department of Corrections. Looking at the prison populations and the bed capacity over the next 10 years, the department's going to be bringing on additional beds at Faribault, as we bring on the new K buildings that the committee has recommended. But as we do that, we'll be pulling people back from Prairie. At any given point, we will have individuals at Prairie. We've got about 1,200 individuals at Prairie today. So any individuals we bring back from Prairie will be going to Faribault. The problem is, we increase our population, we're going to continue to grow back out at Prairie. So we don't have state additional beds or space at existing facilities. Instead, we're going to have to be renting beds and continue to rent beds until, I think it's 2016, when all the beds are going to be full, including Prairie Corrections Facility. So really, we're making that shift as we build new beds to bring them back from Prairie, but at no point in this process will we have additional beds in our existing facilities.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My point only is that these are our prisoners, and if we as a state can't house them with our additional new beds at $9 a day, it's very difficult for me to ask the counties to do it as well. They're saying they have to lease bed space. The counties are saying, therefore, they have to lease bed space. So we just continue to pass this on to our property taxpayers, and I don't think that was the intent when we passed short-term offenders on to the counties. And that's it, Mr. Chair.
That's going to pass. To say that it possibly costs $15 a day to house a prisoner in a county jail that a county jail has owned doesn't work very good in my mathematics. If it costs $15 a day, I want to start renting it out to my kids, because we're going to save a lot of money. I mean, that is just a very strange number. And I suggest you have the county in to give an inaccurate number on this. We worked numbers last year, and we were working numbers from $55 all the way up to about $120. Many of the jails are full, and so we get $9, and we take the state prisoner out, and we rent a cell out for $66. So on the path down, we can't do it, and we take it out and rent another one. Now, I know everybody has to suffer equally, but this looks like a pass down to the property taxpayer, purely a pass down to the property taxpayer, and say, what we do on the state level is required a lot of security. I think when you work the county jail, and especially before people have sentenced, there's a lot of dangerous prisoners there too. They don't turn dangerous just when they're sentenced, just when they're informed that they are actually guilty of the crime. When they're wandering around in the county jail, they're just as dangerous. So I think we have to be pretty careful of not just putting the cut into an easy conduit to pass it down and say, there it goes, let it go to the property tax. Haven't we done a good job with doing this? I don't think we've done a good job with doing it. My second question is the $600,000 for reducing funding for sentence to serve. Is the sentence to serve a state-run program or a county-run program that we're cutting? Deputy Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hawes, to answer this question first, and I'd like to go back and talk about the per diem. The $600,000 is the cost of putting out about five crews and contracting with one of the counties where they hire their own crews. We've got a grant. It's about $100,000 a year to run a crew. The counties will reimburse us up to 50% of that, which generates money into the revenue account, which is a dedicated account that we can continue to use to provide these services. So it's a shared thing with the counties. Now, some counties have gone out on their own and hired their own crews only with county dollars, county tax levy dollars. But right now, what I'm talking about here is a joint effort between counties and states, with the counties picking up half of the cost, the states picking up the other half of the cost.
Follow-up question.
Please,
Mr. Chair. Wait one second.
Are you
done with
that? Yeah, just so that you know, these programs were added to about 10 years ago, and at that time, it was used with just the additional revenue that had been generated, and so they were considered to be temporary, and that revenue fund was depleted to the point that we had to do something, either quit the crews last year or get the new money. This was new money that we got last year so that we could maintain those crews. And if I could just clarify that situation, to run a county jail, is correct. The cost is $55 a day to some of them are $80 a day, but that's with all of the costs, the fixed costs. When I'm talking about a variable cost, I'm talking about if they've got two or three or four beds open and they get two or three or four offenders coming back as a short-term offender on a continual basis, the variable cost is that amount. But whenever you put the fixed cost, if you have to build more beds, if you have to hire more staff, that cost is $55 a day up to $85 a day in the county jail.
Representative Hall.
Thank you. I will wait for counties to give testimony on what the actual cost is. In many of the county jails, you actually have to keep open beds for such things as maybe homecoming, maybe Halloween, maybe whatever it is, so when you're going to arrest 200 or 300 people and you're going to need a bed. So even an open bed situation sometimes has to be programmed in because you're going to need those beds. Otherwise, you're going to have to put Velcro on these people and stick them up in the air someplace. I don't know where you do it. But you better get some expert testimony in so that you get something accurate without spin. Now, I want to know on the sentence to serve people, just help me with identifying the prisoner. Is it a state prisoner in a state institution, or is it a prisoner in the county jail that's in the sentence to serve program?
Mr. Chair,
Deputy Commissioner Nelson.
They are usually a prisoner who is given probation by the courts, and as a condition of that probation, they've been granted the ability to do sentence to service, and if they do the sentence to service and successfully, they can reduce some of their jail sentence. So it's usually a county jailed prisoner who's under probation supervision, but as condition of that supervision, the judge has placed him in jail, but given him a chance to reduce that jail time is the usual situation.
So let me just pause. I just want to understand it now. The cuts that we have here are to reduce appropriation to the counties for housing short-term offenders. That's to the counties, and that will go back to the county taxpayer. Then the second is reduced funding for sentence to serve, and if I'm getting this correct, it's people that are found in the county jail that are going to be out in the sentence to serve, which are going to reduce their sentence maybe by half because they're going to get some time off for that service, and it's going to reduce that amount. And so then the paying for that is going to go back to where? Well, I think it's back to the county taxpayer. I have nothing else to say.
Deputy Commissioner,
that's basically right, that there's some offenders that are given just straight sentence to service by the courts as a condition of that probation. So you're correct that there's, it's not all reduction in jail time.
Thank you.
Representative Bigham, and we're going to have to wrap the DOC up here fairly quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Echoing what a lot of the colleagues have said today, this is another example of the state balancing, what was it?
Sorry.
This is another example of the state balancing the state's budget on the backs of property taxpayers. And these short-term offenders are the state's responsibility. And I was pleased last year when we were able to pass a budget that moved us in the opposite direction, where we were taking responsibility for our short-term offenders. And what I would ask, Mr. Chair, is that sometime before we have to make these decisions, that we do have the counties come and testify in some form regarding how this will affect them, because I do believe that this is going to affect the property tax that they're going to have to enact. So that would be my request, Mr. Chair, is that we have somebody from the various areas of the state, maybe reasonably proportioned, to come and talk about how this will affect them. Thank you.
I think that's a good suggestion. Representative.
Yeah, just echoing that, and I think that's what you're saying, is there could be some kind of a distribution so we could see where the highest impact of that would be.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I guess the question of the chair, after we get done hearing all this testimony from the counties and whoever, what's our role as a committee? Don't we have the option to say, gee, these recommended cuts are great, or do we have the option of saying, no, we don't like them and they should not be made? And or on these line items, we like them or don't like. Don't we have is that our role?
That is our role, and it's my intention that we're going to, unfortunately, because if I had my druthers, we wouldn't be in this position, and we wouldn't be asking you to make these cuts, but I don't have any control over that. But it's my intention that we're going to run this much like we did last year, and we're going to come up with our own budget and our own recommendations that will be bipartisan, I hope, as it was last year, and that will be it. And then we'll pass it out of here on hopefully next Wednesday. So we are on a short time frame, and we'll try to accommodate. I think we should get the counties in here. We'll try to get as much information. Some of the governor's recommendations make sense to me, and some of them don't, quite frankly. And DOC is not being asked to make the kind of cut that some of the other agencies under our purview are being requested by the governor, so we have to balance all that out. Representative Smith.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just an observation in this week-long process that you discussed. Once we all have an opportunity to engage in our own rhetoric, which I see has started this morning, and this is a good thing, frankly, I suspect that my thoughts at this point are that the public safety committee finance in the area of public safety should be the last area to look for any cuts when they need to be made, since that is the primary role of any government, is to provide public safety. So this will be an interesting few days.
Thank you. Representative Cole.
Very briefly, Mr. Chair, quickly to follow up on Representative Smith's point, do you know, has leadership informed you if there will be a target for this committee, or and maybe you explained that before I came in, but...
No, I didn't. Representative Cole, I believe we're getting those Friday.
Okay.
And I agree with Representative Smith, and I'm going to do all I can to make sure that the cuts to public safety finance are minimized, but I don't have total control of it. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I believe you're getting them Monday.
Monday?
That'll give us lots of time to add. Mr. Chair, just one follow-up. Then I sent you a note there. I was trying to recall the status last year. I believe myself and I think Representative Hillstrom asked for, and I believe it was included in the omnibus bill, a study on per diem rates and for our county jails. And I'm trying to recall what the timing was on that. It may not be due back yet, but I don't believe I've seen it.
Mr. Chair, I'll let Ken Merz answer that. He's been very active on that committee, and I'll let him.
Well, Mr. Chair, my name is Ken Merz. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Corrections, and Representative Colt, we have had a committee together looking at that. We've developed a form that the legislation required the commissioner to develop to send out to all counties to uniformly report their expenses and to come up with a uniform per diem. That has been completed. The form has been sent out to the sheriffs, to the counties, for their final review. The commissioner has reviewed it, she has approved it, and we will be sending that out very shortly. And so we should have an average per diem for 2007, probably within the next 2 months.
That's
not
cool.
Thanks, sir.
Is there anyone from the public that wishes to testify about the overview of the Department of Corrections? Seeing nobody, then Commissioner, thank you, and thank you all for your testimony. We'll be in touch. Department of Public Safety, Deputy Commissioner Ellison, are you handling this here solo?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm up here solo, but I have a cast of very able people directly behind me that can answer, I'm sure, any question that comes up. For the record, my name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. The total budget for the Department of Public Safety is right around $400 million a year. When we look at general fund money, however, it's about $100 million a year. And the cuts that the governor is recommending to the Department of Public Safety amounts to about 1.8% of the general fund budget.
In the public safety area, when we look at where the general fund dollars are within the Department of Public Safety, we have them primarily in two of our divisions, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the Office of Justice Programs. And you'll see from the governor's recommendations, that's where the primary reductions are suggested. In the public safety area, first of all, there is a request for disaster assistance state match for this for this fiscal year, and this $350,000 request for additional funds, and then I'll get to the reductions. And again, it relates to the 2006 flood in the Red River Valley. This is the state match to the federal disaster assistance funds that we get to cover that particular disaster. In the reduction area, the first reduction is a reduction of $653,000 per year beginning in 2009 for crime victim services. That equates to a 2% cut across the board to all of the different crime victim programs that we fund. The next budget reduction is in the area of CrimNet. That budget reduction suggestion is for $608,000 a year. As you'll recall from prior testimony with CrimNet, they have a large number of interdependent projects. And so what this will mean is that various components of projects will be put off and take a longer period of time to complete. And again, we have people in the audience that can answer specific questions with regard to that. The Financial Crimes Task Force, there's a suggested reduction here of $450,000 a year, which leaves a base budget for the Financial Crimes Task Force of $300,000 a year. There is no question that that will certainly significantly impact the operations of the Financial Crimes Task Force. What we found, however, the past few years of the operation is that there has really been a reluctance on the part of local police agencies to participate in the task force, even at 100% reimbursement for officer participation. We find that it isn't a high priority area for local units of government, although it has a devastating impact on people who are victims of financial crime. There's no doubt about that. It's been difficult to get local agencies across the state to participate. The $300,000 will certainly allow for the commander to continue to operate. It will continue to operate some funding at the local level. Also, this is an area where we feel in state government that this is an opportunity to really look at how we handle financial crimes task forces within the state. You'll remember that the Department of Commerce some years ago started a insurance fraud unit. We have this operation going within the Department of Public Safety. We've been talking with Commerce and trying to think about ideas for really reorganizing this effort and making it more collaborative across departments. The next reduction area is in the area of CAT teams and hazardous materials. This is a small reduction of $40,000 per year in that budget category. This will reduce the general fund appropriation, but there is funding that comes for this operation from billing companies for who are responsible for hazardous materials release into the environment. Those are the reductions that are recommended by the governor in the public safety area. Then one small reduction of the general fund in the transportation area relates to the Republican National Convention coordinator. We hired a coordinator to begin the efforts to coordinate all the different state agency activities. This was a request that we made last year. We did have a person that was working in that capacity. She did a wonderful job, brought all the different state agencies together. What we found by the end of last summer was that she had done sufficient amount of work setting the groundwork and getting everybody together that we were able to absorb this coordination activity within our existing resources. And so she went back into retirement. That's a brief overview of the budget reductions that the governor is recommending. Again, I have people here that can answer specific questions, or I can answer any of your questions as well.
Deputy Commissioner, we made some. You're talking about a $608,000 reduction to CrimNet. So which programs within CrimNet will be deferred or cut back?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's the identity access management program that would be deferred.
Say that again.
Identity access management project.
Tell me more about that.
My understanding of that project, and I would ask Superintendent O'Malley to come down. My understanding of that particular project is that it's making sure that the people who are accessing the criminal records, that we have a way to identify them consistently throughout the process of them accessing those records. And I'll ask Superintendent O'Malley to clarify or correct if I'm not speaking.
Superintendent, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tim O'Malley. I'm the superintendent of DCA. I'm joined by Dave Johnson, who's the executive director of CRIMNET. Deputy Commissioner is accurate in her overview of what this program is. It's a project that's designed so that there'd be a single identity access to get into a number of the different databases that CRIMNET is combining. For example, the Predatory Offender Registration database and the Minnesota Repository of Arrest Photos database. If a law enforcement officer or somebody else in criminal justice wants to access them, they'd have to sign on two times. The idea is to come down with a single password, a single expiration time. It would add to efficiency and actually add to security, too, so that there wouldn't be so many passwords and other things out there for the criminal justice practitioners to use. And ultimately, it would lead to several other databases. When you ran a driver's license check or a vehicle check or orders for protection, right? The idea is we'd ultimately get to a single sign-on. And depending on where you're at in the criminal justice system, if you're a police officer, probation officer, an attorney, whatever it might be, you would get access then to what you're allowed to have access to under data practices in a single sign-on. It would be much more efficient and more secure in the long run.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have concerns about these cuts, too, especially to the victim services and hazmat teams, but I'm going to focus my questions on the Financial Crimes Task Force, which, with personal experience, do very good work. And my question is, have you looked at grants with the various department stores, Target, any of the other major, Best Buy, any of the major department stores that could maybe match money? The other thing, I want to applaud you for looking and being innovative with the merge with the Department of Commerce. I think that's a move in the right direction, and I think when we're facing a deficit like this, with this amount, a good way to overcome that and is to be innovative with how we solve this problem, and that is one way. So I just want to applaud you for looking in that direction, too.
Deputy Commissioner Allison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bingham, in terms of business participation, the Financial Crimes Task Force does have pretty significant business contributions to their effort. I know they work... I've worked with various different retailers that have provided funding. The banking industry has provided funding, and I don't have all of those details in front of me, but they have done actually a pretty good job with getting some funding and some in-kind support from various businesses.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back to the CRIMNET project, Identity Access Password. What's the statewide impact of that? Is it going to be operating some places but not others, or is the whole program going to be deferred to a later time?
Superintendent O'Malley.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a little bit of each, actually. Well, first of all, it would be consistent across the state. Some part of the state wouldn't get something that another part wouldn't. That would not be the case. Yet it is not completely deferred either. We would move the original budget for next year was about $700,000. This is a $380,000 cost, so a little over 50%. We would still move this forward, but it would be delayed. We would try to combine a couple of those databases for a single sign-on. Ultimately, there are probably seven or eight databases that we would move to over several years, but it would be a delay in that implementation.
Mr.
Chair, Superintendent O'Malley, then what's happening to the other $300,000?
Superintendent O'Malley.
The remaining $300,000? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that was just on the identity access. The other effect of the $608,000, there's $228,000that will be reduced in the budget for the rapid identification technology rollout. That's the flat print that we do, the two finger IDs. Those devices that we're going to be rolled out into workhouses, jails, other division in the criminal justice system, that would be delayed. They would not go out, no. That both that hardware and software would not be purchased, and they would not go out.
And
Representative Mr.
Chair, and then so the counties and jails will have to, how will they, keep on using the pad with the fingerprints, or what?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, no, the live scan devices are out there. Those are the 10 print that we do now that instantly go to the BCA we described before so that you can get the turnaround very quickly, you know who's in your jail. But there are two finger ID devices that are out there, and there's also some simple flat print ones that are out there. They're used by law enforcement officers in the field in their vehicles. 5 years ago, we had zero accesses to the two finger ID. Last year, we had over 100,000 because we deployed devices out there. So when a police officer makes a stop, for example, and they have reasonable suspicion, or the person voluntarily wants to put their two fingers in the device, we can, within a minute, get back, oh, we know who this person is, based on biometrics rather than just name and date of birth. There's a number of those devices out there. The next step was to put more of those devices for probation officers in the courts, in some jails. Occasionally you see where someone will be inadvertently let out of jail because they don't have one of those right at the door, and they just check everybody. Same thing in court, same thing in probation, so you know exactly who you're dealing with. The ultimate goal in all of this is to get the biometrics as our base for identifying everybody in the criminal justice system. So the more of those devices that we have in the field, the more certain we are that the person that they move through the criminal justice system, it is the same person each time.
And
Representative Murphy.
Superintendent, then there's another 50,000?
Well, I'd have to look at my math. I believe it was, Mr. Chairman, it was $380,000 was the reduction for the Identity Access Management Project, and $228,000 for the Rapid ID Technology Project.
Thank you.
Representative
Zeller. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to return to Representative Bingham with the topic area. Deputy Commissioner, the well over 50% cut to the Financial Crimes Task Force, can you tell me, was that the governor's recommendation, or was that your department's recommendation?
Deputy Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Michael Campion, my name, I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety. We offered the Governor's Office a menu of suggested cuts or options, and certainly that was one of them.
So he chose the reduction himself, or his, it's ultimately just the decision rests with him. He was the one who chose to reduce the $450,000.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
when it gets down to that point, whether it's the governor or his staff, I couldn't tell you, but the office made that decision.
Commissioner, do you have a copy of that list that we can provide the committee?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a copy of that list.
No. And was it your recommendation that you cut $653,000 from Crime Victim Services? And how did you base that decision?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could just say, when you look at the Department of Public Safety and you look at where the general fund dollars are, they're really in the Office of Justice Programs and in the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Those are the main budget categories. And so as the budget recommendations were developed, we had to provide options to the governor's office to say, here are the areas where we have general fund dollars.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison, how did you come to the conclusion that Crime Victim Services should be cut?
Mr. Chair, Representative the Committee, we did not come to the conclusion that Crime Victim Services should be cut. What we said was to the governor's office and what we would say to the legislature, if you're looking for general fund dollars to cut, here are the different options where we have funding within the Department of Public Safety. And so depending upon where you want to see services reduced or what kind of pain we're going to all suffer, here are the options. So it's not a question of wanting anything to be cut. It's a question of here's where the general fund dollars are, and so if we need to cut general fund dollars, these areas are going to be impacted.
Well, maybe I misunderstood your response to Representative Zeller. It sounded like you had a priority list that you sent to the governor.
Well, Mr. Chair, none of these decisions are easy. I mean, there's only crime victims in the BCA.
I'm asking that.
This committee struggled with forensic scientists and what to do with those issues. And forensic scientist is one of the places conceivably that could be cut, or the special agents that are assigned throughout the state of Minnesota. The governor's office could have cut any of those programs. It chose to cut what is in front of you, and it wasn't easy for us. One of the things that I'm most proud of being Commissioner of Public Safety is our affiliation with crime victims. That's not easy, Mr. Chair, but what's in front of you is what's in front of you.
Yes,
Mr. Chairman, that's quite right. Deputy Commissioner, you said in your, when you were going over the cut to the Finance Crimes Task Force, that this was not a high priority for local communities. I vehemently disagree with you. As you know, I'm one of the representatives on the Financial Crimes Task Force, and this is the gateway. Identity theft is the gateway to multiple crimes. When it comes to boosting a checking account on 5 different names to go out and buy all the byproducts necessary for methamphetamine production to then sell the methamphetamine for either profit or use. I mean, these are, when you go into the mortgage, the, I don't know if you call it a ongoing problem when it comes to the stealing identity for mortgage theft, when you're looking at some of the contractors who are using fake identities to purchase homes, sell them out to a shadow buyer. I mean, this is not just this is a big local issue. And in the past, this has been an issue with the department and with this group. And quite frankly, if you're going to move it to Commerce, maybe that's best, because quite honestly, I think you've done an awfully poor job of servicing this department. The Financial Crimes Task Force, an issue that is absolutely exploding around our state and our country. If that's the recommendation, I'd rather just move the whole thing over to Commerce than to have you underfund, undermanned, and underappreciate the work that's being done. This is a big priority locally.
Mr. Chairman, I respond. Mr. Chair, Representative Dillard, I understand your concern. The point that I was making is we've been administering these grants within the Department of Public Safety on behalf of the Financial Crimes Task Force for several years. And what we find is that it's difficult for local agencies to commit officers to this work. When you look at rape, burglaries, assault compared to financial crimes, it's just a difficult choice for local departments to make. And this particular task force reimburses at 100%. That's much, much greater level of reimbursement for task force participation in financial crimes work versus gang and drug task forces. It's the highest rate of reimbursement that we have, and even with that, we have trouble getting jurisdictions to participate. I in no way want to leave the impression that financial crimes is not devastating to the victims, because it's very devastating. But when you're looking also at the Department of Public Safety, and we're looking at the wonderful work that rape centers do, better women's programs do, domestic violence programs do, abused children's programs do, and compare that with financial crimes task forces, it's just difficult to say that we have the pain only in the crimes against persons and not in the crimes against the financial area.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Deputy Commissioner. That again, my concern wasn't with the fact that there wasn't a budget cut, but I've been looking down the sheet here at some of the 2.7, 2.8, 3.9, those that have percentages and doing ballpark math, no one is over 50%, well over 50%. So again, Mr. Chairman, if the recommendation is from the department to remove this function from their purview, then I'd be all for it, because again, I'd rather see that this priority, and again, it is a priority. It is not to say that the others are not, but this is becoming a bigger and bigger problem that is affecting every segment, every state, part of our state. It has no geographic or ethnic or financial background. There's no limitations. It is every single person, and I just think that if we're not going to do a good job with it, if we're going to do a half or a quarter or a third of a job under Department of Public Safety, then let's move it to Commerce where they can do a better job.
No, at this point, I mean, remember, these are just recommendations at this point.
Sure.
We have a number of people signed up. Representative Lilly.
I think some others, Mr. Chair, had some questions on this point.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And just to add on to what Representative Sellers has said, I agree that all these cuts are going to be painful and all the referral vetting. But when we talk about crimes in general, I've seen the Financial Task Force solve murders because of the technology and the skill that they have when the violent crime detectives didn't have a lead. And it was because they were able to help them out and work with them through the technology and their investigation tactics to get and solve these crimes. And I know there's a recent crime where an individual was murdered and they're going after the financial records because her purse was stolen. It's stuff like that that we need to make sure that we're, we're not being short-sighted on this. This is a very important team, very important task force, and I don't know that I'm quite ready to jump on board with sending them over to Commerce, but Representative Zellers makes a good point that I applaud you for looking into it, and if it's going to be a better suit over in the Department of Commerce and it's going to get better attention, then maybe that's where we got to go. But with that, I mean, I'll just have my comments there, but this is a very important task force.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair, and testifiers, I'm not sure who this question should be directed to, but I see in your in the proposal that housing of short-term offenders, you have our ID cards. I'll definitely pass.
Okay. Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You stated that you kind of gave the governor a menu of things that the governor then could choose from and that you didn't necessarily recommend that this was the item. Is it possible for us to get a complete copy of the menu so that as we are picking, we can choose which items we prefer?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilton, I'll look into it.
Thank you.
I believe it's private data, but I don't know that for a fact. And I don't know that we've got a document that we could copy and give to you quite frankly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Otherwise, I guess maybe we should be asking the departments to develop a menu on our behalf so that we can pick and choose what it is that we would like to look at.
Mr. Chair, may I respond?
Definitely.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilton, you really have the menu. I mean, you have the budget. And if you're looking at a particular percentage cut to general fund, all you need to do is look in our budget and determine what area you think should be cut and then develop a budget proposal. So really there isn't any secret money that isn't fully open and available in the budget document.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At some point, the experts gave advice to the governor, and I would like to have the benefit of the advice that you gave to the governor. I don't want to just randomly open the book and say, oh, I think we ought to cut it here, or I think we ought to cut it there. I would think that you would want to have a seat at the table and saying, this is what we think are the choices, and these are things that we think ought to be off the table for public safety reasons or for whatever other reasons. At some point, you know, the documents can't, or the recommendations can't be a big secret. I mean, we all need to know what the upsides and the downsides of whatever areas we might have to cut are. And so I just think that the legislature should have the benefit of those discussions and those documents as well.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilton, I understand that. I think what we get calls from legislators, we get calls from Mr. Carter, we get calls from the governor's office to say, you know, we're thinking of cutting X. What do you think are the implications of that? And we provide that information as best we can to the governor's office, and we'd be happy to provide it to you.
Okay, we have a couple more. Next.
Mr. Chair, I think we're sometimes get a little parochial here in this committee. I'm a little worried about getting lists and priority lists and what the reasoning for that is. I don't want to sit here and go over the priority list and their private list. And it's kind of a non-related subject, but the other day, due to any of the state agencies, we were going over the big thing is two-line fishing, and the author of the bill sat there, and he says the only people that are against this is the DNR. Well, duh, that's what we pay them for, and that's what we pay them these folks for. These folks are the professionals. If they come up with a list, I think we should defer to the list. Now, I personally was on the CrimNet board, and they pushed my button when they said they're going to cut CrimNet. And each one of us has probably got a certain area, but at some point, we got to defer to these people that are the professionals. That's what we pay them for. And I'm not interested in dragging the whole budget, go line, and second-guessing them. I'd like to look at the list, but this little privy list that they sent the governor isn't a big thing to me. That's what he asked them to do. And it seems like when we forget that these are people and professionals. They're not little soldiers of the governor doing whatever. They put their input, and they've got buy-in, and they've been in these agencies for years and years, and they have a real heart for it. They're not just minions of the governor, so I think we should trust them a little bit in their decision.
Now, Carl. Oh, did you want to respond to
that? Representative Curtis, that is exactly my point. I don't believe that they are just little soldiers to the governor, but just because they made a recommendation to the governor doesn't mean that the governor followed it. And the difference is us looking into what items were recommended that could be cut that potentially weren't the governor's priorities. I think that it's the legislature's responsibility to listen to the staff. This is the governor's responsibility. And you can't make the same decisions or even evaluate whether a decision is good if you don't know what went into the decisions. And so I'm not trying to get into the governor's business. I just want to make sure that we know what was recommended so that we can decide if we like something else better. That's all.
Just to redefine our roles between micromanaging and reinventing the wheel and oversight. That's all.
That's cool.
Mr. Chairman, this is a very interesting discussion, and I think it's a very important discussion. I think we need, and I don't say this to be the governor's defender here, because I strongly, strongly believe in separation of powers, and I strongly guard our role as the legislature to make these budget decisions. It's our responsibility. However, the governor has a responsibility under law to come forward with some recommendations. And he's done that. His decision process and what the departments may or may not have told him, we better tread very, very carefully if we're going to go down the line of trying to gather that information from the department, from the governor, the governor's office himself. We absolutely have the responsibility as a committee to ask the department to comment on the decisions we are considering making, but to reach into the governor's decision-making process is, I believe, if it's not overstepping our bounds and reaching into the executive's prerogative, again, separation of powers. We have a role, the governor has a role, the judiciary has a role. We better tread very, very carefully, because I think that's a dangerous, dangerous precedent for this committee or this legislature to set, I don't say that as a partisan for the governor at all. I think I would have the same concern regardless of who was sitting in that corner of the Capitol building and who was making those decisions. We need to be very, very careful, Representative Hillstrom, about overstepping our role and reaching into the governor's decision-making process. We need to exercise our independent legislative authority prerogative. If you have questions of the department, when I have questions of the department, I will ask them and I will seek their input. But to ask for them to share with us their communications with the governor, to me, I hope the governor's office is watching this closely, and I hope that the department is watching this closely. I know there's a lot of talk around the legislature about trying to reach in and understand those conversations, but I have a serious, serious concern about us overstepping our role, just as I would have a concern about the governor's office stepping into the legislative role beyond what he's required to do by statute.
Okay, we're running a little short on time here with this. Representative Zellers and Dominguez.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since I started this mess, I'll probably take responsibility. And President Hillstrom, as someone who actually sued my governor when it came to government shutdown and who should be spending money on what services, believe me, I take this very seriously. And my, as Representative Cornyn said, getting your buttons pushed about a particular issue that you're very passionate about, this was one of them. There's many on there. You and I share a lot of the same passions about some of those issues, but as the chair said at the very beginning, these are recommendations. We are the legislative branch, and again, as we were part of a lawsuit to say which stuff the governor and a judge should and should not be able to spend without legislative approval. So I take this very seriously. Again, if we want to ask about recommendations for particular issue areas or any one of the budget items, that's great, but there has to be some sort of council amongst commissioners. And again,
Mr. Campion, that it's the behalf of Governor Plenty. So if we're not going, if we're going to interrupt that conversation between his commissioner and himself, I think that's a dangerous precedent as well. But again, my zeal wasn't to decide who decided where and when on the docket, check this or, you know, cross that off. My rationale was to why a budget was cut by over 60%. So, again, my apologies, Mr. Chairman. I should have just taken your lead and said, these are recommendations. We will proceed as such and make our recommendations back to the executive branch and those other guys in the other chamber.
Dominguez, and then we're going to move on to public testimony on DPS.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. Representative Coles, I think you're right in saying what roles we have to play here in this body. But also we have to have a role in how we answer to our constituents and where these dollars go. And so I just want to make sure that we can answer those questions when we're asked upon our constituents from the state of Minnesota, where are these dollars going and why these budget cuts. And so we need those answers to really verify why the cuts. And so I just wanted to throw that out so we know as a legislator how we can work with the governor. But we also have to keep in mind where our constituents stand on these issues.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dominguez, the governor does not cut the budget, the legislature does. The governor makes some recommendations, but we're the ones who are accountable for setting the state's budget. So in answering your constituents, it's the decisions that will be made by the 201 of us in the legislature, ultimately signed by the governor, but he does not cut the budget. That's our responsibility.
Okay. Is there anyone from the... thank you, Commissioner, Superintendent, Deputy Commissioner, for your testimony. We'll be in touch. Is there anyone from the audience who wishes to provide any public testimony? Please come forward. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Chairman Kumar, members of the community, my name is Donna Dunn. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And I thank you for the opportunity to briefly address our concerns about funding levels for sexual assault advocacy programs in Minnesota. I am very aware, if I wasn't before the last 10 minutes, I am now, of the looming budget challenges for Minnesota. I'm also aware of the governor's proposed cut in transition services programs, which include advocacy and support services for sexual assault survivors. I'm here to let you know just how critical it is to maintain the current funding level for the safety of our communities and for the health and well-being of sexual assault victim survivors in Minnesota. The Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault is the statewide advocacy voice for victims and survivors, sexual assault programs, and allies committed to ending sexual violence. We provide training, technical assistance, networking, and support to over 70 programs that are coordinating a whole range of 24-hour-per-day services in all but 13 of Minnesota's counties. The programs under MnTAC's umbrella work tirelessly to counteract the messages which support this commonly occurring but uncommonly hidden crime. We know sexual violence to be the most underreported violent crime in our communities. It happens in private. It happens between people known to one another. The secrecy, victim blaming, and shame that victim survivors experience keeps them from trusting that helping services and communities will indeed help. Advocacy programs exist to counterbalance that trend. Programs are there to help victim survivors know what options are open to them, to help traditional systems such as the criminal justice system, the healthcare system, the mental health system, the school system, understand what help and role they can take to ensure that victim survivors find the safety and the support they need in the aftermath of assault. Ultimately, our goal is to create safety for victims, accountability for offenders, and justice in our communities. This isn't an idle issue in Minnesota. Minnesota research indicates that 1 in 4 Minnesota girls and 1 in 7 Minnesota boys are victims of sexual violence. Last year, the Minnesota Department of Health issued a report called The Cost of Sexual Violence in Minnesota, in which they cited that in 2005, this issue alone cost Minnesota over $8 billion. We say over $8 billion because we know that the report did not capture the cost of local, city, county, and or tribal costs in responding to sexual violence. We are missing the local cost of law enforcement services, jail, medical services, prosecution, probation services, and so on. The report also cites that in 2005, 61,000 Minnesotans were sexually assaulted. This is enough to fill the Metrodome for a home game. But of course, this is not a game. The base level of funding to sexual assault advocacy programs is just over $43,000 per county. With this funding, our programs are expected to provide crisis services 24 hours a day, general services which link victim survivors with programs and services they need, assistance with transportation, information and referral, assistance during law enforcement investigations, during medical examinations, during court activities, in filing compensation claims, in filing restraining orders, in accessing human, social, and family services, assistance with interpretation, translation, culturally appropriate materials, and to do a series of ongoing support groups. Additionally, our programs are required to assure that staff, including volunteers, are competently trained and supervised, that the community is educated and awareness is raised, that professionals are trained and systems are changed to better meet the needs of victims, and that programs partner in communities to ensure seamless service across a variety of programs functioning in a community. This is a lot of service for $43,000. And we do not argue with these standards. We know these are all critical elements of an effective community program. And we recognize also how unrealistic it is to do these really critical and essential services with the current resources. Thanks to you, we experienced an increase in our base funding for programs last year. In fact, 2007 marks the first adjustment in state funding, the first positive adjustment in state funding since 1996 to support the increased demand for sexual assault services. I want you to know that this increase has been an important piece in the puzzle of providing community services to sexual assault victims. Our programs increasingly face new and emerging trends. We hear from our program in Rochester that the increase in cases involving complications is taxing them. Complications means everything from the need to find and use interpreters to increasing to their recognition of an increasing number of cases involving mental health issues of either offenders or victims. And that, of course, we know further complicates the process. Longer investigations they are experiencing provide or call forth a need to provide longer support to victims in order to keep them engaged in the process until they have their day in court. Our program in St. Cloud indicates that the number of cases reported by advocacy, law enforcement, and the hospital has risen dramatically over the past year, and the advocates are spread thin in responding. And in Ramsey County and Hennepin County, we have really only three programs which are attempting to serve a population of millions, covering several square miles, many square miles. I know it is not lost on you. It is primarily through victims' access to advocacy and other community-based systems that we are able to identify sex offenders in our midst. We are able to intervene in sex offending behavior and to hopefully work towards holding those offenders accountable and changing offending behavior. I'd like you to know that all of our partner programs are experiencing pressures and changes in their communities. The increase awarded last year has enhanced their ability to respond to these increasing demands. The needs are real. We are not trying to guard against a potential threat. This is a real threat in Minnesota communities. The cost report that I alluded to earlier outlines in dollars the personal and community devastation that accompanies sexual violence. The network of programs across the state is working to intervene in the cycle of violence to offer hope and resources for victims. And they do so on a very thin dime. This is the very time it is critical to keep the funding intact and to assure that our commitment to safety and accountability and justice in our communities comes closer to keeping pace with the rising demand for help. Thank you, and I ask you to keep these thoughts in mind as you make your very difficult budget considerations.
Very good. Thank you, Ms.
Thank you for your testimony. Do you have any information that you could share with the committee about how grants to either crime victims programs generally or in your case sexual violence grants from the state compare to what other states either in the region or around the country are doing? How does Minnesota rank in terms of the amount of money appropriated by the state for these types of programs to various nonprofits?
Don, do you have that information?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, unfortunately, I do not have that information. I do know that historically Minnesota was was far ahead of the trend. We were one of the first states to step into, for the state to step into using state revenue to support these programs back when those programs began in the 70s. I don't know how we have kept pace. I would be happy to find out.
Mr. Chair, you would have that information. There's no urgency to it. I don't know that it's going to impact our budget decisions, but I'd be interested in that if you could follow up with
me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you said this in your testimony, but maybe you could mention it again. What is the current budget that that your program is operating with in the state?
Mr. Chair, Representative, our programs have a base level of funding somewhere around $43,000. The entire amount of funding, I do have it here. For this year, as I understand, the sexual assault program, the state amount that goes to sexual assault advocacy is $1.5 million for this current year.
And what portion of this cut would be reflected in your program?
As I understand, this would be a cut of approximately 2% to the base, so it would be 2% of that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dunn, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else? Okay, we're running a little bit. We're going to run a little bit over our allotted time here, so we can hear from the Community Correction Act counties. Can I have a motion from someone for the minutes of to approve the minutes of March 5th and March 6th?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Dominguez moves the minutes of March 5th and 6th. Is there any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed. That motion prevails. Now we will hear from the Community Correction Act counties. Sorry that we're bringing up so late. If you can keep your testimony to about 10 minutes, that we'd appreciate it.
I'll begin, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. My name is Ryan Erdman. I'm the Director and Legislative Liaison for the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act counties, referred to as MACAC, if you heard that around us. Brief introductory remarks about who we are as an association. We represent all 32 counties that provide correctional services under the provisions of the Community Corrections Act of 1973. The 32 counties, some of them are in joint powers arrangements. We have 17 jurisdictions supervising offenders, roughly 100,000 offenders under supervision. That accounts for about 75% of offenders on probation in Minnesota are in one of our counties. And I have with me the Deputy Director of Ramsey County Community Corrections, Andy Erickson, and the Director of Washington County Community Corrections, Tom Adkins, and I'll let those two gentlemen speak to the budget more directly.
Thanks, Tom. I'm Andy Erickson from Ramsey County. First and foremost, I don't normally go here, but I really want to commend Commissioner Fabian and her staff and the recommendations that they've come up with as it relates to the cut, significantly under the 4% that other state departments have been required to do, no cuts to probation funding. I'll give some examples as it relates to the STS crews and the STO and that kind of thing, the short-term offender. But I think we'll be fortunate, we'll consider ourselves fortunate if the cuts don't get any worse. And this is something that we could probably work with. There is a chart, I believe it's been handed out, that's in black and white, and I've got a smaller color version of that that I just want to draw your attention to and put a little context and then give you some data. It says correctional spending in Minnesota since 2001 based on the biennial budget appropriations. And it's just doing a little comparison over this six-year period of time about the changes in state funding to different parts of the criminal justice system. First one, public defense. Second one, administration, the Department of Corrections. The Department of Corrections institutions, meaning the state prisons. And then finally, probation. You can see that we're struggling to kind of stay afloat and stay current with what some of the other elements of the criminal justice system. So we've been averaging just a little over 1% a year in increases in state aid compared to what some of the other elements are. I'm debating whether to hand out a chart or just talk about it. I wanted to give some context for Ramsey County in particular. During this period of time, that 2000 to 2007, we've experienced a growth in our felony cases of 21%. Our supervised release cases, which are those folks that once they're released from prison, they are in the community and we are supervising them. That's been up 40% since 2000. And our DWI cases have gone up 12%. So it's a difficult time for us to manage all of that. And then finally on the STS crews, which is sentenced to service, the state pays for half of the cost of three of our crews. And that's going to be cut by 20% under this proposal. So, and then finally on the short-term offenders, we looked at what that impact if this recommendation goes forward, and it's just under $450,000 to Ramsey County if the short-term offender reimbursement goes back to the $10 rather than go up to the $30, or that it has this past 12 months. So that probably wasn't clear.
So it's $450,000 that Ramsey County would absorb, is that what you said?
And covering the rest of the cost of placing those short-term offenders in the Ramsey County workhouse. And I think I'm done. Turn the rest over to Tom.
We have a question for you first, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Chair. Do you have any idea what kind of an impact that would have on property taxes of $450,000? Because, like in my community, for every $100,000 we spend, that's a 1% increase in property taxes.
Mr. Erickson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, one of the issues with the short-term offenders that some of the short-term offender costs are within a corrections budget, some are with the sheriff in different counties around the state. In Ramsey, for example, it's in the corrections. What do we have, a $16 million budget? So, that $450,000 is a fair amount of money.
And that?
Mr. Murphy.
At some other time, if you could tell us, like on a $200,000 house, what would it be?
I'd be glad to get that information.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Atkins, did you want to address the committee?
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. And it is one of the challenges of coming out here and testifying on these kinds of things is not having that immediate information, but we'd be glad to get back to you with that. I also want to say that I'm thankful that in this public safety area that we're not seeing larger cuts at this point from the governor's recommendations. Field services is an area that has not kept up with funding over the years. A couple of things in the past have helped us. In the mid-90s, we saw caseload workload reduction money come in. The other issue that helped us survive the 90s with some reasonable caseloads compared to what they could have been was the fact that we started targeting very carefully the risk of the offender and moving large numbers of people to administrative caseloads. And what that means is that people with lower risk are on caseloads of 500 to 1,000 people at that time. We've done that. In recent times, we have less of those kinds of administrative changes to make, and the efficiencies that we gain now are much smaller efficiencies, and so if funding doesn't keep up, our caseloads continue to grow. As was already mentioned by the Department of Corrections, supervised release has grown significantly. I believe they mentioned 37%. Our felony caseload in Washington County is not alone with that. The increases you see in the institutions is obviously just a function of having to house offenders. On the caseloads in community supervision, they tend to be a little bit more transparent, or less transparent, I guess, and they go away in the process. They become something that people don't see as easily. And we really do struggle with that, and so we're very appreciative that those are not an area that's being targeted for cuts at this point in time. That 8% increase since 2000 obviously made a big dip during the interim years, and only last year, because of the thanks to this committee and the work that was done, that we saw an increase at that point in time. That's helpful to us. Protecting that is very helpful to us, and we're very appreciative of the Department of Corrections not going after that money. I'm not here to advocate for cuts to property tax dollars. These things do impact us in that area, and I understand that the short-term offender is a significant issue. It will not be an easy one for us to deal with in that area. Probation is a downstream part of the criminal justice system. We're much like the folks who live south of Madison this year in Wisconsin who have gotten all the snows. They're going to have water coming down those rivers in significant amounts. That's one of the things that's happened with probation departments. And so the protection of the field services is a very important part for us to help us retain those. We would be happy to answer any questions that you may have this morning. If not, we will at least get you the information at a future time. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just wanted to go back to the chart that Mr. Erickson, and I assume that this group came from you?
It came from you, okay.
You know, that's very impressive, but I guess that, well, the point's kind of been made here, but I just want to clarify a little bit. What we're looking at here is just state appropriations. This has not total budgets. And I assume that when we add in the county dollars, that probation community services piece is considerably bigger than that in terms of growth over that period of time. Would that be correct?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I know, for example, in Olmsted County a couple of years ago, the property tax increase to go into corrections was a 26% increase. But the budget itself didn't grow that much because that was the year 2003-2004 where the state cuts occurred. So the budgets do continue to grow at a faster rate than 1.5% per year, absolutely. And a lot of that is being picked up by the property taxes.
Right, if I may, Mrs. Chair. Yeah, thank you for that. And I'm just, I guess my point just is that, you know, we need to be really careful because, you know, I'm afraid that we're going to see again this year what we've seen in the past, which is that we cut our budget at the state level and it looks really good, and aren't we being, you know, fiscally responsible? And then, in fact, what we're doing is just making a shift to property taxes again. So, you know, I think this is one area where, you know, that we have to be really cognizant of that.
Any other questions? Gentlemen, thank you for your testimony. Remember, members, we are meeting on Friday at the first deadline, so we have to have all the bills out of our committee. You can have that on your schedule. If there's no further discussion, this meeting is adjourned.